Over the past few years, we've done a number of underreported segments about the dispute over Kashmir. And recently, there have been some interesting developments, including Pakistan President Pervez Musharraf's new proposal for a solution to the dispute. So we thought we would get an update on the situation for the second part of today's Underreported. And with me now is journalist Michael Dybert, who recently returned from Kashmir. And his in-depth piece on the dispute will appear soon in the New World Policy Journal. I'm very pleased to welcome him back to our show. Hello.
Thank you very much for having me, Leonard.
People who have heard our previous Underreported reports will know the basics of the dispute over Kashmir. But for those who haven't, can we do the brief explanation?
Sure. Well, I mean, kind of the user's guide, I guess, to the situation in Kashmir is most of the dispute has its roots kind of in the twilight of the British colonial rule of what is now India and Pakistan. And it was around 1947 when Kashmir at the time was being ruled by a Hindu Maharaja known as Hari Singh, was his name. And a group of tribesmen backed by Pakistan rushed into the state, and Hari Singh petitioned the government in India, such as it was, to rush to his assistance. But he had to, in exchange for that, sign off to grant the accession of Kashmir to India.
Well, this is at the time of partition.
Yes.
And some states were going into Pakistan, other states were going into India. And we have the situation where there's this influx of Muslims to make it a majority Muslim area, even though there's a Hindu leader, or were there already a lot of Muslims there?
Well, there was a historically Muslim majority in Kashmir, and today it's in fact actually India's only Muslim majority state. It has a population of about 12 million. But there was also a substantial population of Hindus and Sikhs at the time. And unfortunately, when violence kind of erupted after the 1987 legislative elections there, a lot of the Hindus who are known as Pandits were driven out of the territory.
There have been calls for a plebiscite over the years, but India has resisted?
Yeah. Well, actually, in 1948, there was a UN resolution that posited that Kashmiris should have a plebiscite on the status of the state, but it only gave them the option to accede to either Pakistan or India. And from my experience on the ground, most of the Kashmiris, in fact, would like some kind of semi-autonomy from both entities.
My guest is Michael Dybert, who's just returned from Kashmir and is writing about the situation there in the World Policy Journal. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Why is this so coveted by both India and Pakistan? Is it rich in natural resources, or is this a matter of national pride?
Well, I think it's a matter of national pride in some degree. I mean, especially for India, I think the idea of Kashmir being part of India is inextricably kind of linked into India's identity of itself. Because if Kashmir is allowed to succeed, you know, there are secessionist movements in different parts of India. I mean, you have the Ulfa in Assam and the northeast of India and Bengal who are trying to, advocate, so they say, for minority rights there. There are the Naxalite communist rebels, Maoist rebels in the eastern part of India as well. And for Pakistan, I mean, I think over the years, historically, it has proved a very low-cost way to tie down half of the Indian army by throwing some of their weight into this kind of jihad ink that they've created there.
So there has been terrorism and armed struggle. And that's become a basic part of everyday life in Kashmir?
Yeah, I mean, the sad part is, I mean, the Kashmiris are kind of caught between, on one hand, you have the Indian army who has committed, I would say, I mean, massive and very pervasive human rights abuses against the population there. And then on the other side, you have the militants who, you know, for instance, think nothing of assassinating politicians who are willing to take part in the Indian electoral system.
There have been so-called encounter killings taking place recently.
Yeah, and this is a very, very serious problem because essentially what encounter killings, it's kind of a strange euphemism for extrajudicial execution. But what has been happening is that Indian security forces have been basically seizing people who have nothing to do with the militancy, say in one part of Kashmir, they'll seize them in the eastern part of the state, take them to the western part of the state, kill them, say that they were in some kind of an encounter with Islamic militants, and then in return, there's a strange system of payouts and promotions in the Indian army. India, the Indian government has arrested, I think it was 11 security personnel, including the senior superintendent and deputy superintendent of this town called Ganderbal, which is outside of Kashmir's capital of Srinagar.
And how have Kashmiri political leaders responded to what's going on?
Well, you know, it's still a very complicated and volatile situation, but I think there are some glimmers of hope right now. The spiritual leader of Kashmir's Sunni Muslims, a man, Mirwais Umar Farooq, whose father was actually slain in 1990, has visited Pakistan this year and declared that there was an end to armed struggle, that he was not supporting armed struggle as a means to free Kashmir from Indian rule. And I thought that was a, you know, especially coupled with the Musharraf proposal, I thought it was a brave move.
So in a way, we are seeing parallels to what's going on in Northern Ireland. At least he's trying to do that kind of a breakthrough.
In fact, it's interesting you mentioned that, because when I was riding through Srinagar in a car with Mirwais Umar Farooq, he had mentioned that he had just returned from Northern Ireland, where he was studying aspects of the peace process.
And how was his statement received?
I mean, I think India was very happy to hear it. And I think, you know, when you had the Musharraf government talking about a formula that for the first time made no Pakistani claim on Indian-controlled Kashmir, I think, you know, there was a lot of support for that statement. On the other hand, there are some militant groups based in what they call POK, Pakistan-occupied Kashmir, because half of Kashmir, it's divided between Pakistan and India, who were very resistant to that. But at some point, I mean, speaking to people on the ground, the average Kashmiri, you know, you have these militants who are sitting in Pakistani-occupied Kashmir sending young men to go on these kind of suicide missions against India. I mean, I don't know at this point how much they really have the best interests of the Kashmiris on the ground at heart.
So when President Musharraf proposes a solution that would grant Kashmir de facto independence, is he really doing something that is sticking a finger in the eye of India, or is he coming up with something that India might be able to live with?
Well, I mean, now that he didn't predicate this particular last proposal on on Kashmiri independence either. So I think there's a window of kind of maybe opportunity here between the two sides. But, you know, Pakistan and India have such a historically kind of poisonous relationship with one another over this issue in particular. I mean, there's some worry, I think, in the Kashmiris' part as to whether they're just insulting one another politely across the table now as opposed to doing it in the press.
Is that, do you think, the motivation for Pakistan to make this offer?
I would hope not. I mean, I think in some ways, you know, 20 years of war almost at this point, exactly 20 years of war. I mean, I think it maybe there's a little bit of mutual exhaustion on both sides.
But it's interesting that India, which is proud of being the world's largest democracy, would engage in things like these extrajudicial executions, which is really a euphemism for murder by soldiers.
Yeah, it's very troubling. And the problem is, I mean, I remember reading a Human Rights Watch report that came out in September of 2006, and they said there was a pattern of impunity in these extrajudicial executions and people being, you know, protected. And when I was in Kashmir, I talked to literally dozens of people who had family members disappeared, none of whom had ever received any kind of justice. And I think when this was just happening in Kashmir, it was, to the rest of India at large, it was something of this out of sight, out of mind problem. But now, in fact, they're talking about there are fake encounter killings happening in other parts of India, in Gujarat, for instance, which is very close to Bombay, and, you know, in places such as, you know, Punjab. And so I think this problem, which was at one point isolated, has now become accepted practice for some elements of the military.
On the other hand, the Sunnis, isn't there a Wahhabi element here? Wahhabism is the perhaps the most, at this point, one of the most violent wings of Sunni Muslim Islam, the one that grows out of Saudi Arabia that inspired Osama bin Laden.
Well, generally, I think in terms of the homegrown Islamic culture of Kashmir, I mean, there's a fairly moderate strain of Sunni Islam and Sufism as well. But in terms of the militants who come and you know, commit atrocities in India proper, such as you know, the attack on the Red Fort or something like that, or the attack on the parliament who say they're doing it for Kashmir, some of them are foreign and some of them are Pakistani. And it could be argued that some of them maybe were influenced by the Wahhabist ideology.
So when you were talking to people, you got a sense that the majority of Kashmiris are moderate and would like to see an end to this violence finally?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think so. And it's something that's a little bit depressing for me, I guess, as a journalist, is there are some very fine journalists in India, don't get me wrong, and there are some very courageous ones. But sometimes when I read the Indian press, there's a tendency to tar all of the Kashmiris as some kind of quasi-Taliban in their back door, which is, I don't think at all the case. I think many of them are very moderate, and many of them are willing to accept some sort of semi-autonomy. You know, I think the things that are important to them is to have Kashmir as a kind of semi-independent political entity, to have the border between Pakistan-occupied and Indian-occupied Kashmir become irrelevant, and things like that. So I don't think it's so much a hard and fast push for total independence anymore.
Salman Rushdie has written about Kashmir, the Kashmir of his childhood, as some kind of a paradise on earth, and says no longer. What is life like for most Kashmiris as a result of this kind of power struggle?
I mean, I think it's particularly tragic because, as you say, I mean, Kashmir is definitely one of the most beautiful places I've ever seen in the world. I mean, you have these towering snow-covered mountains, you have these rushing mountain streams, pine forests. It's really quite spectacular scenery. But I think because of the situation between the Islamists and between the Indian military and being caught between it, I think the Kashmiris are very frightened and really don't know who to trust. And it's sad because it doesn't. It's a subject that gets virtually no coverage in the United States, as far as I'm concerned.
And there's no tourism anymore because people are afraid?
There's a little bit, but not that much. I mean, Kashmir, historically, Srinagar especially, has this beautiful lake, the Dal Lake, which is kind of this pristine, huge mountain lake. And historically, they would have kind of honeymoon couples who would come there and stay on houseboats and things like that. And when I was there, you know, almost all of the houseboats were sitting empty, which was a rather melancholy sight.
And I understand that the lake has kind of shrunk in recent years. Is that because – that can't be because of the conflict. That's because of global warming?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's amazingly one thing that you can't blame the politicians in India and Pakistan for.
Well, we can blame politicians for global warming to some degree,
right,
but not this conflict.
True, yes, exactly. And I mean, I had heard a bit about the fact that the lake had been shrinking and things like that, but supposedly the state government had some kind of rehabilitation program for the lake that had cleaned it up a bit and was trying to address that, but I'm not actually sure on the specifics of that. It still looked pretty immense to me.
How long were you there?
I was there for about 2.5 weeks.
Mm-hmm. Can you really get a sense of what's going on when you do that kind of, forgive me for using the phrase, parachute journalism?
Yeah, I mean, I did my best, you know. I mean, I took public transportation all over the place, and I talked to a lot of people outside of villages, not just Srinagar. And I mean, I find that some of the best ways, you know, I've reported in a lot of kind of, for lack of a better phrase, developing countries. And I think the best way that you can get a sense of that is just doing that, taking public transportation, speaking to people. You get great opportunities talking in the back of a bus or maybe in a little restaurant or something like that with people who aren't necessarily politicians but have a great deal of insight into the situation.
Thank you so much for giving us this update on today's Underreported. Michael Dibert, who's recently returned from Kashmir and is working on an in-depth piece on the dispute that will appear in the World Policy Journal. When will that come out?
That should be out. It's in the spring edition, so it should be within the next month or so, I think.